thank you for being here tonight. It's an encouragement to see you. It's an encouragement to be able to open God's Word with you. We're in Deuteronomy chapter 2. If you have your Bible, I encourage you to be turning along there with us. Hopefully, also looking along in the notes you may have taken, the study material that we have provided. If you're still in need of that, there's a couple ways to get a hold of it. One is in the there in the foyer. There's still some copies there. If you prefer a digital copy, they are available on our website as well. If you need help finding that, I'd be more than happy to help you locate it. Deuteronomy chapter 2, we are continuing sort of the history lesson, almost said Paul, Moses begins with, as he begins this, this kind of the first sermon to the Israelites. Let's remind ourselves once again where we are, what's going on historically in terms of Israel. Well, that's a giveaway. It is about Israel, but where is Israel? About what time would you say? We're talking about Israel, but when?
About the time they are coming out of the wilderness, about 38 years
ago. Okay. So they're coming out of the wilderness. They're preparing to go into Canaan. They're in this area preparing the plains of Moab, kind of preparing to go in. Tonight's study, well, for one, before we get into chapter 2, chapter 1 was kind of a downer chapter. You start the story and you're thinking, yay, we leave Sinai. And then chapter 1 is basically the story of why they spent 40 years in the wilderness, 38 of it wandering around, not going to Canaan when it is but an 11-day walk from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, and they took 40 years to do that. Why is it that they had to do that? And we looked at that story last week. It's a retelling of Numbers 13 and 14 with some extra details thrown in. Tonight's lesson is going to be on the upswing, and they're going to prepare to enter Canaan. And as they do so, we're going to get some positive reinforcement and from some unusual places in these two chapters. Israel is reminded that the reason why they're getting their land is because God's giving it to them. And so we're going to see examples of that as we go in. Examples of non-Israelites who got their land and who got their land in spite of the circumstances, in spite of there being giants and really scary, terrifying people. So let's jump into the chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 1 through 8. If someone can help me out on what did you see when you read through that section, what did you find there? First 8 verses, just a couple lines or a couple words for that. What did you see?
Esau.
Say that again.
Esau.
Yes. So we have, all right, listen, I love verse 1. And for many days we traveled around Mount Seir. That's like the understatement of the two chapters. Right? This is what you say when you don't want to really reveal the details. For many days we wandered around. Yeah, many days covers it. Many decades covers it. We wandered around here. And I love verse 2. You've been traveling around this mountain country long enough. That's it. It's time to go. It's time to go into Canaan. As they're going to go into Canaan, they're going to pass through the territory of Esau. And the instructions were, as we heard just a second ago, leave Esau alone. From someone else, why were they to leave Esau alone? Okay. Yeah, it's deeper than just God's friendly with Esau, you know. It's Esau's of common lineage. And we're going to see that a couple of times in this chapter. In fact, 3 times within the 2 chapters. We're going through. We have a command to leave the wilderness. And they are instructed to pass through Edom peacefully. Now, before we move off of this section, does that happen? Does what they are told to do happen? By that I mean, did they walk through their land? No. The interesting part, Numbers chapter 20, they didn't let them. Esau showed up in arms and said, you're not doing that. And so they had to make the big roundabout trip around Edom. At one point, they noticed they were going back towards the direction of the Red Sea, and so they were very upset by that. It's Numbers chapter 20. We studied that not all that long ago. That's when you have the incident where the bronze serpent and that sort of thing, Numbers 21, the first part of that chapter. Okay. 9 through 15, I didn't break this up very well. It's really the rest of verse 8 through verse 15. What are we dealing with there? Okay. Yeah, so for certain. So if you're down towards the bottom of that, like say verses 14, 15, that area, you have our time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Book of Zered was 38 years. It didn't take 38 years to walk there. you could probably walk around the earth in less than that. It was because of their disobedience. And we have this fulfillment of something that was referenced already in the Book of Numbers, that entire generation would die. Just prior to that, who are we talking about? Yeah, same idea, but with Moab. Okay, do not harass Moab. They're told not to mess with Esau. They're also told not to mess with Moab. Why can't they mess with Moab? Common lineage again, right? Moab and Ammon, through rather uncomfortable terms, are kinfolk to the Israelites. And so for a lot of reasons, the same reason why they can't cross through Edom or Esau's territory is the reason why they cannot cross through Moab. So this happens to show us something else, though. Ar, the country of Ar, had been given to the people of Lot. That should be your reminder that they are kinfolk. Who were living there and then were dispossessed by the Moabites? Did you notice that in this section? Yeah. Yeah. There were some descendants of the Anakim, or they're also counted as Rephaim, it says. The Moabites had an interesting name for them, Emim, or Emim, however you say that. Roughly, it translates to frightful or terrible. They had the exact same thing Israel did. A bunch of scary people living in their land. They were given the land and they went and drove them off. That sounds familiar. Sounds like Numbers 13, where Israel saw a bunch of scary people in their land and instead refused to drive them off. But the fact that Moab did it should be an encouragement, I hope. Moving on. 16 through 37, really. What do we see there? There's two big sections, but what do we see mainly? Well, if you want to break it up, you can. If you want to break it up just down to verse 23, you could do that as well. What do we see next in chapter 2?
They destroy the king of Sion, his area.
Okay. So beginning around 21, 22, 23, that area, they're told to go and cross over into the valley of the Arnon, it says. Into their hand had been given Sihon the Amorite. All right. Just before that, in chapter 2, what do we read? It's the same thing again, right? The same thing we read about with Edom, with Moab, with Ammon. Ammon, remember Moab's brother from Lot. Again, bad circumstances. The Ammonites, guess what, had a people formerly living in their land. Those people were Rephaim. They gave them a name. The name is not nearly as scary what it translates to, but it's the same idea. It's some moniker that they put on them. But they were a people great and many, tall as the Anakim, but the Lord destroyed them and gave the Ammonites their land. It's twice now we've heard about a group of descendants of Abraham encountering people that are scary in their land, and both times God has run those people off and given the land to them. It's the same thing, right? We're hopefully starting to see a theme. Beginning in verse 26, we have the account of what happens with Sihon, king of Heshbon. They send a messenger to him, basically offering the same thing they offered to Edom. They rejected it. It says here, the Lord hardened his heart. We've had that discussion from Exodus. The Lord presents circumstances that folks can reject and maybe would likely reject. You remember in that in Exodus, it's back and forth between who hardened whose heart. But long story short, it was made obstinate, as it says there. And the land is given to them. It says, "Behold, I have begun to give Sihon and his land over to you. Begin to take possession that you may occupy his land." They come out to battle at Jahaz. What happens? I can rest you assured, the phone did not ring at Jahaz. A few thousand years before electricity. Say it again. Sorry. No. What happened to Jahaz when they fought Sihon, king of the Amorites? Yeah, they won. And not just won. Like you said, they destroyed them. Kind of overwhelmed them, right? When you win in a military fashion, you defeat him and his sons and all his people. You might say, okay, we captured all his cities. That sounds good. Devoted to destruction, every city, men, women, and children, we left no survivors. The only things they took captive or hostage were the animals. Everything else died. This was the way they overwhelmed them. Of course, they were told to do that at God's instruction. It wasn't just their bright idea to start having war this way. This was how they were told to. I'm glad you mentioned verse 25. Verse 25 is an interesting verse because up until now, the shoe's been on the other foot. It's been Israel terrified of their enemies. And now, the enemies are going to be terrified of Israel. We're going to get a reversal of what it was before. Excellent. Chapter 3. What do we see first and foremost? Chapter 3. We get maybe the most unpopular biblical baby name ever. Who are we talking about at the beginning of chapter 3? Og of Bashan. Or Og of Bashan, probably. I would imagine. What happened when they fought Og of Bashan?
We got a lot.
Oh, they won.
They had 60 cities. They destroyed everything except the camels.
That's right. Same story, different king. What they did to Sihon, they did to Og. Okay. And as you read later in the Old Testament, those two names are almost always tied together. You're going to read that a lot as you move forward in the Old Testament. Sihon and Og. Right? Remember what we did to Sihon and Og. Right? Because those were the first two major victories going into the Canaanite conquest. Sometimes we think, you know, victory number one was Jericho. It really wasn't. Right? It was the first one crossing the Jordan, which is a big deal. And, you know, it's its own thing. But these first two victories get played over and over and over again in their history. As a reminder, here's what I did to you. Og has the interesting reference in verses 11 and 12. We have sort of that parenthetical statement. We're going to talk about those in a few minutes. What does it say there about Og?
He was the last king of the giants until some large rebellion.
Yeah. He was a remnant of the Rephaim. He was a remnant of that giant race. And then it tells us about how big his bed was. Okay. I don't think we can take his bed and extrapolate exactly how big he was, other than the fact that he's big. Okay, he's a big guy. He wouldn't have slept, you know, head and feet at the exact end of a bed, I would imagine. But big dude. Okay. There are some thoughts that maybe it's not his bed. I don't entertain those, so we're going to move on. 12 through 18. We have a retelling of a familiar story, or what should be a familiar story. What's given in 12 through 18, or really, if you want to, 12 through 22 of chapter 3? Okay. Was the territory east of the Jordan originally part of the promise?
No.
It's actually not the promised land. So then why did they get it? Remember the story from Numbers 32? Yeah, two and a half tribes. Do you remember which two and a half? Close. Jebusites were not Israelites. There you go. Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Okay. So we have the firstborn, we have one of the sons of Jacob, and then we have Gad, kind of just thrown in there for good measure. They see the land, you remember Numbers 32, and they say, this is a great land, we really want it. And so they make this back and forth with Moses, you remember, and Moses tells them, you know, if you possess that land, then you're going to have to go fight on the western side of the Jordan for the rest of the land, and they agree to that, and As far as we could tell, they fulfilled that oath to do that. It was sort of really a big deal, right? That they would want to live on the other side of the river from the rest of Israel. It's a disquieting sort of desire that they have to be separate, and that doesn't play well later in their history. But anyway, this is the retelling of that account. Okay, the Lord had given them this land on the eastern side. Okay, the last one there, 23 through 29, sort of a poignant, kind of off to the side scene. What do we get there in the last bit of chapter 3? Is this recorded in Numbers or anywhere else? No. In Numbers, we find out what happened to Moses, and we find out his sentence, but we don't get this conversation. This is one of the most interesting things about Deuteronomy, is that every now and again we get this personal sort of side on the story. You remember, Deuteronomy is the first book written from a largely Moses' perspective, right? Many of the other books are written from third person. You know, the Israelites did this, the Israelites did that. When you read Deuteronomy, and it says, "And I commanded you at that time," Moses is literally speaking. He's speaking to the people, and this is what he said. So it's a first person kind of thing. So you get this really kind of a sad ending to chapter 3. You know, Moses pleads with God to allow him to go over and see, and it's heartbreaking. He says, "The good land beyond the Jordan, that good hill country in Lebanon." You know, he really, really wanted to see that. By God's grace, he was allowed to see it. He wasn't allowed to go. But anyway, that's what we get at the end of chapter 3. All right, your turn. When you went through the text, what did you notice? What did you see? We've mentioned a few of them already, so if you want to repeat one of those or something like that, feel free. But what did you notice as you went through? Or some version of it, I'd say probably three times. Right? Don't mess with Edom. Don't mess with Moab. Don't mess with Ammon. Don't mess with the three of those. Exactly. But when it came time to contend, God says, go contend with Sihon. Go contend with Og, and they destroy them. Yes, sir.
This may be a minor point, but I think it's really important for us to remember in chapter 2, we see that God had dealings with other people than the Israelites.
Right.
We're given the story of the Israelites so we understand how God's plan with Jesus came to be fulfilled. God dealt with other people as well.
That's exactly right. It wasn't just the Israelites. There were other things going on. What we know of his dealings with other people are really only where they intersect with Israel, because the Old Testament's largely the story of Israel, you know, and God's dealings with them. So we find out about everything else kind of where it crosses over the Israelite storyline. But absolutely, there are dealings with other nations. God has a plan for the rest of the nations. It's a pretty amazing plan. He's going to bring them into the covenant of Abraham. But that story's long to be told. All right, what else did you notice? What did you see?
Repetition of they dispossessed them and settled their place.
Yep.
It was a different version. Third time, first time, second.
But it's a little but same idea, though, right? The idea of, so they were dispossessed, destroyed, and settled in their place. I like the first time it's written. This is Deuteronomy 2, roundabout verses 10 through 12. It says, as Israel did to the land of their possession. But they haven't done it yet. It's going to happen, right? This is one of those places in Deuteronomy where we have a kind of a parenthetical statement. I'll go ahead and put this up here because this is good. It gives you the references in these two chapters. There are six of them that I could find. You get these kind of breaks in what Moses was saying to fill in some details, right? The first time it happens in chapter 2, verses 10 through 12, you get this story about who the Emim were. Right? Now, Moses didn't stop and kind of go to the side and explain who the Emim were. Either it was written in later, it had to be written in later. Right? And we see that from verses like this, when it references what Israel did. Right? So some of this was written post-Moses. Had to be. Because when Moses dies, they're not in the land yet. And this is one of those places where you see that. Chapter 2, verses 20 through 23. You get another one of those parenthetical statements. We're going to explain who these people are that are run off by the Ammonites. Chapter 3 and verse 9, you're going to get another one of those. Who the Sidonians called Mount Hermon in terms of the mountain that they're on and so on. Okay, you get a lot of these in this section. It's just something to kind of notice. Right? Little breaks in the story that fill in some of the details for a later audience. Okay. All right, what else did you notice? I'm going to go through a few things, but I want to give you an opportunity. Yeah.
The repetition of "you do not fear, they will fear you," and thinking of that in the context of the 40-year lesson they just had about don't fear, that's you do what you need to do instead of fearing.
Yeah, fear is what got them into this mess. Now they're on the way out of the mess, and God's reminding them, don't be afraid. Man, a good, valuable lesson for us. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I think that the one that you read is just this is about how powerful God is.
Yes, absolutely.
So it's mentioning them, but it's really about how powerful God is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is over and over Israel being reminded, you don't need only to look at your own experience. That would be a huge thing, by the way, but look around you and see what God did. You know, these nations were given their land, and their lands were all seemed to be filled with giant, terrifying people. And God ran them out and let them settle. You know, how will God, this is one of my things Israel should have learned from this, how will God not do that for you? You know, did I see a absolutely. Yep. It's all based on God's promises. If you're on the right side of those promises, you're in good shape. Yeah,
absolutely.
Rahab's, I love her version of it because you get, if you want to call it the Gentile or the Canaanite perspective. And she says, we've been terrified of you guys. Seeing you come on. And we've gotten a little bit of that already, haven't we, in Numbers? Wasn't it Balak who looked out and he saw the people and it says, they lick up the earth like a cow licks up grass. We're in trouble, you know. Go find me a soothsayer to curse this guy. Yes, sir. Well, only one of you can speak, so. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's something you're not going to see. Pretty much from here on out, you're not going to see that anymore. You have the whole, as soon as you get into the promised land, you have Jericho, you got to hold stuff back. It goes downhill.
Yeah, it wanes. It gets less and less and less like these two. And then by, you know, Judges 1, there's a big list of tribes. Nobody did it. Did the thing they were supposed to do. So that led to problems that they had going on. Absolutely. I mentioned Balak, and I wanted to mention this too. If you're reading Deuteronomy and you're thinking, okay, Moses is kind of following the story from Numbers, and we just got done with Numbers, so it's at least a little bit fresh. We're thinking, okay, we see the Sihon thing, we see the Og thing. Where's the Balaam story? Do you notice that? Moses' sort of history lesson in chapters 1 through 3 totally leaves out four chapters of Numbers, 22, 23, 24, and 25, if you want to go to beyond Balaam. I think there's a good reason for that. 22, 23, 24, the Balaam story in Numbers, if you think about it, really had nothing to do with Israel. Right? They were down in the valley doing their thing, and then you had Balak and Balaam and all the story kind of happening over here off to the side. That really had no bearing on them personally. Okay? So if Moses brings this up in Deuteronomy, it could be like, what do you mean, Balaam? You know what I mean? It didn't fit in the scene where they are and what he's saying. So just something to think about. The incident at Peor is not mentioned either, but that's another thing that you might notice as you go through. As Bill mentioned and several have mentioned, there's repeated references to people being given lands and possessing lands. That's what we're getting ready to do, you know. As Israelites, we're getting ready to go possess land, and it's leading into Israel's call. The fear that the Israelites had of the Canaanites, you can see that back in chapter 1, is reversed once they start to go in. Instead of they being in dread and terror of the Canaanites are in dread and terror of them. You know, because God certainly made it that way. And then we've mentioned also between Edom and Moab and Ammon, they're descendants of Abraham. Descendants of Abraham were promised success. Abraham was told he would be father of many nations. Those nations would be nations like Moab, Ammon, Edom, Israel, eventually. Of course, it would have greater fulfillment later on, but you have promises that are made to Abraham's descendants that you can see having been fulfilled just as you kind of work your way through chapters 2 and 3. Okay, next thing. What should Israel have learned from all of this? Oh, I'm sorry, we had another couple of things here. We talked about this. See what they did for them. They'll do so for you. I'm way ahead of myself. All right, let's do that one. What should Israel have learned from all this? Israel's in the wilderness hearing Moses speak these words. What should they learn? All right, we always want to hear it from their angle first.
Well, they're just
absolutely. It's all examples. It's all reinforcement for what they're about to do. See what I did for all these nations that are not you. Here's what I'm going to do for you.
And I thought it was interesting. You know, one of the things that the spies that originally went into Canaan came back, two big things they had. People are giants, and they got 45 cities. Each one of these, Esau, Moab, and Ammon, all had giants living in the land.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't specifically say that when they're talking about Esau, but verses 23 and 24 talk about that those same inhabitants were there in Esau.
Yep.
So, you know, that's one of the big things they have is there's giants there. And God took care of them. And then, when they first had their battle,
mm-hmm.
So the two big things they had, they struck down pretty fast.
Yeah. They're the old line from, you remember from Numbers, we seem like grasshoppers to them, and so we seem to them, you know. Not anymore, right? It's all going to be fixed. All right, what else did you see? What else should an Israelite hearing, reading these words have learned from them?
They should have learned from this that the promised land is going to be there, and they're going to be taking it under God's guidance.
Yeah, a little, you're absolutely right, the idea that, that he took care of you and he led you through. You remember it was God that said, you know, I fed you with manna in the wilderness, a little later on in Deuteronomy, so that I could prove to you that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. It's the same thing Jesus quotes in Matthew 4. Absolutely, they should look at this and say, God's been carrying us, like it said in chapter 1, like a son carries, or sorry, father carries his son. You know, God's been caring for them in this way. All right, one more thing that you noticed, all right. They, they're listening to the man tell them, I can't go. Right? And we heard the story. If you're hearing this live, it would have been just a few moments ago. Chapter 1. If this is being preached live to you, it's only a few seconds after he said what he said in chapter 1. You know, where he was, you know, he was led to a place where he had an opportunity to rebel, and he did. And then you hear this at the end of chapter 3 where I begged God to go in and I couldn't go. That should work on them as a means of, I need to take this as warning. You know, this isn't, you know, remember who died, although that's a powerful lesson too. The man standing there telling you I can't go, he needs to be a warning for them, for certain. A couple of other things, and I would carry on, but time is, as always, against us. We had a little bit of a reference there, I think an encouragement to Joshua specifically. Joshua's going to have to carry the torch into Canaan because Moses cannot. Moses is not going to cross the river. Joshua is. But prior to crossing the river, Joshua is given a couple of key examples of what God can do. He's shown, with Moses in leadership and Joshua certainly in a leadership role, what God did to Sihon and Og. He will most certainly do that to your Canaanite enemies, the ones on the western side of the Jordan. You know, and we also, you remember, as Joshua begins, you have that repeated refrain, be strong and courageous, right, early in the book of Joshua. Joshua himself could have learned something also from what was said. Israel should have learned that their fear was in the wrong place. When you and I get our fear in the wrong place, it tends to not go so well. We get to be afraid of all the wrong things. Fear God, you know, and let the rest kind of fall where it will, because God's going to make sure it falls where it should. The Israelites hearing this should have remembered the old line from Genesis. I remember from Genesis 31, when they're talking about who God is. It's a couple of times in Genesis God's called the fear of Isaac. Not just the God of Abraham, but the fear of Isaac. Right? Like, literally the one thing Isaac was concerned with was God. And I think that's a good way to think about that. All right, the other thing, as we talked about and was mentioned a minute ago, this is anticipation. This is building, right? This is sort of the pep talk as we get ready to go in. It's a long pep talk. I mean, it's, you know, 30-something chapters. But it's preparing them to go, and so there needs to be this anticipation. We're about to go. You know, Moses wouldn't be given this if we're going to wander around another 40 years. This is literally, we're getting ready to kick off here. And so I hope it would have been a hopeful thing for them, something to look forward to. Okay, a couple things. How can we apply it to ourselves? Oh, there's a verse in Matthew chapter 6 that says, consider the birds of the air. God cares for them. God cares for the grass of the field. He cares for every living thing on this earth. And yet the only thing on this earth that has a choice whether or not to follow him is us. And he cares for us too. You know, if Israel needed to relearn that they needed to seek God first and let the rest go, then I think that's a good lesson for you and I also. Let God take care of it. You know, what he decides will be best because it's God. Bill, did you have a thought?
How many times in Exodus did you promise?
Over and over.
How many times do you think about
look forward to a promised land, and stop thinking the wilderness is home. We get all bent out of shape when we think we're home and we have to leave. If we get it out of my thick head that I'm not home, then my perspective changes. You know, I'm looking for somewhere else. This idea of Moses being sort of a living warning, I think has a large resemblance to Esau, actually, from, you remember the account from Hebrews chapter 12? Esau sells his birthright, and then no matter what he could do, no matter what he wanted to do, he couldn't get it back. Hebrews 12 says, even though he sought it with tears, use them as examples of people who had everything and threw it away. Moses threw away Canaan in a moment of anger. Esau threw away his inheritance in a moment of weakness and really non-concern for his birthright. And the Hebrew writer's telling them, don't fail to obtain the grace like they did, or like he did. Don't fail to obtain the promised land like the dead generation that is still lying in the wilderness. I think we can also take some application from the victories that have already been had. The crux of Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2 is Christ has been raised from the dead, and because of that, now all these other things fall into place. Because he is both Lord and Christ, whom you've crucified, then a response needs to be made. Then faith can be had in him, right? Everything goes after that. But it starts with a victory first. It starts with Christ being raised from the dead. He is the victory that causes us to look forward to all the rest. It gives us inspiration to go on and move forward. We don't have to close our eyes in death hoping that God for the first time will be victorious. He's been victorious again and again and again and again and again. We just have to have faith that he's not going to change. And that's the thing we're told about in Scripture. I, the Lord, do not change, he says of himself. Our fear, as we talked about a moment ago, it has to be properly placed in God. We're told in Matthew chapter 10, do not fear him who can kill the body. Put your fear in who it belongs, right? And let the rest go. All right, there's always more to say. But that's the way Bible study goes. Chapter 4, Lord willing, I'd love to study that with you next week. It'll be just chapter 4. Some weeks is one chapter, some weeks are two chapters. I think maybe there's a 3 somewhere later. But for the most part, it goes pretty much at that pace. All right. Look forward to studying that with you all next week. We get a sort of a change in the type of sermon that we have, so it'll be good. Thank you all.